It's really nice to be back. Great to see you all. What I'm really looking forward to is the dialogue afterwards, and some of you are really good at that, so I'll not rush through, but I tend to get long-winded, so I'm going to really force myself not to do that this time. I will say this to begin with. The guy pronounces his name wrong. I, too, say Jonathan Haidt, but no, he will firmly correct you. It's Jonathan Haidt. It's like H-I-T-E. That's how he says it. You get to say how you pronounce your own name. I respect him. Increasingly, American culture is divided between what seem to be two tribes, the red tribe and the blue tribe. Conservatives and liberals, right? I hope that makes sense. In recent decades, each tribe has been drinking its own whiskey. And predictably, dialogue between the two groups is proving elusive, at times seeming impossible. The situation is dangerous, but it's hard to take seriously sometimes because of the entertainment value that goes back and forth between the two tribes. Let me start us out on a light note by telling you one of these, and it's the story, said to be apocryphal by some, is reported by the pugnacious atheist Christopher Hitchens. You're familiar with him? You've read maybe some of his essays. He's great. He's terrific. The popular Texas governor, Ann Richards, remember her? Ann Richards? Yes. Ann Richards was campaigning to be a governor of Texas in 1990. Her Republican opponent, one Clayton Williams, was strongly against bilingualism in Texas schools. Richards, by contrast, was in favor of it. And Williams proudly summed up his argument with the pronouncement on the matter: if English was good enough for Jesus, it's good enough for Texas. He didn't get to be governor, so that's probably a good thing. My interest here is not whether this exchange between Richards and Williams actually occurred as Hitchens reports it. My interest is in, and me too, the unbridled glee that liberals tend to feel when they hear stories like this. I mean, it's right up there with the photograph of the angry protester a few years ago defiantly holding up a sign that says, "Keep your government hands off my Medicare." Okay. Yes, this is naive foolery, but having too much fun with it is playing with fire, especially so here in the early decades of the 21st century. Why? Because sober critics, sober political scientists and sociologists opine that the United States has not been so culturally divided since the Civil War. And if that doesn't alarm you, I really think it should. You know, this, we're playing with fire here. We're saying, "Well, come on, hey, this is America." No, actually, we can get ourselves into some serious trouble here. The evolutionary psychologist Jonathan Haidt is one of those who's alarmed by this cultural divide. But more than being alarmed, he is also interested in it. Specifically, he's interested in the dynamics that make it possible. What allows liberals and conservatives not only to talk past each other, but to develop such a towering contempt for each other's ideas, when in fact the very notion of representative democracy is based on the idea we need different viewpoints, and out of that exchange of ideas will come the best way to proceed? Because nobody, not Jefferson, no single genius, no committee of geniuses can come up with the answers to this incredibly complex, dynamic, rapidly changing thing that is culture. It requires that dialogue of ideas. Otherwise, we're kind of lost, and we are losing our capacity to hold that dialogue, except, you know, basically as an insult contest. What's happening, according to Haidt, is rooted in our deep evolutionary history. In an important 2001 paper titled — this is not anything to do with next week now, but The Emotional Dog and Its Rational Tail, it's a science paper, actually. He makes the distinction between moral instincts on the one hand, right? So we've got moral instincts and moral reasons on the other. How many of you have read Haidt at all? Anybody? Okay, so a little bit of this might be familiar. To illustrate the distinction, Haidt tells a story of a brother and sister. It's a short story. Here it is. Julie and Mark are brother and sister. They are traveling together in France on summer vacation from college. One night they are staying alone in a cabin near the beach. They decide that it would be interesting and fun if they tried making love. Julie was already taking birth control pills, and Mark used a condom too, just to be safe. They both enjoyed making love, but they decide not to do it again. They keep that night as a special secret, which makes them feel closer to each other than ever. What do you think? Was it okay for them to make love? They like it. They decided never to do it again. It's a special moment. So, ladies and gentlemen of the moral jury, was there anything wrong with what they did? And by the way, remember, the genetic consequences of incest are off the board because she had birth control pills, he used a condom. And I won't pull the class here now, but Haidt gives a report. He tells this story often, and he says that most people feel an immediate revulsion to the situation. That feeling, in Haidt's view, is instinctual, not rational. Moral instincts are very rapid and they are deeply certain. People experiencing moral instincts are not susceptible to a lot of reasons why or what. It's just wrong, right? In fact, they tend to be contemptuous of such reasons. If you engage them in dialogue, they will experiment with this reason or that reason, perhaps, but will end up reasserting, probably in a louder voice this time, that, damn it, it's just wrong. Should you persist? Should you be unwise enough to persist in attempting to, no, let's talk further about this. They will tend to do things like, this conversation is over. Slam of door, right? I mean, and they walk out of the room. Something about moral instincts evokes a sort of intensity that doesn't welcome dialogue. And actually, there's a reason for that. What's actually happening? The key is in what Haidt tells us about that's moral instincts. They're certain. They come on very quickly. It's wrong. That's the end of the story. Moral reasoning, by contrast, plays a trick on all of us, especially like Team Blue, especially the Blue Tribe, the liberals. He says, and I'm quoting now from his paper, everyday moral reasoners are sometimes said to be like scientists who learn by forming and testing hypotheses, who build working models of the social world as they interact with it, and who consult these models when making judgments. This, says Haidt, is complete illusion. That's not what's going on at all. They pride themselves on their rationality, and they take their reason to function like a detective, like a scientist. Just the facts, ma'am, right? I mean, we're just going to get the facts here. And Haidt is famous for asserting that this seeming objectivity is in fact an illusion. Human reason is far less a scientist and far more a lawyer, right? A lawyer that's going to build your case, whatever case that you want. This is not a newsflash in Western thought. It was David Hume who said famously, reason is and ought to be passion's slave. But most of the Enlightenment thinking and most of the thinking up to now is, well, reason is going to be this test. Let's just be cool and objective and reason. Reason is never objective. Reason is, have you ever had you've had the experience of you go out and your car door creaks. Damn it, this car is getting old. You know, I should think about getting a new car. You know what? I need a new car, damn it. And all of a sudden, the reason is there starting to shovel reasons why you really need not just a new car, but a Lexus, come on, you want one, right? This is, and it might not be the wisest decision for you at the time, but your reason will do that for you. Your reason is ceaselessly coming up with clever justifications for why, for doing what you really want to do all along. The distinction, again, between instincts, moral instincts, and moral reason is rooted in evolution. And specifically what's important about this is the timing in evolution of the emergence of instincts on the one hand and the emergence of reason on the other. And this is of decisive importance. We developed our moral instincts, that thing that's just wrong, right? We developed our moral instincts long before we were human. This is a fact. As most of us consider being human, our moral instincts were installed by natural selection before the emergence of that complex consciousness by which we can do moral reasoning, by which we use complex language. We're proud of that, and rightly so. It sets us off from other animals. It also sets us off from our immediately antecedent species. They are called archaic Homo sapiens in contemporary evolutionary discourse. You can't just say Homo sapiens because it doesn't say enough. The archaic Homo sapiens went extinct probably about 50,000 years ago. And they didn't have the kind of language. They look just like us. They're sometimes referred to as anatomically modern human. Nobody wore clothes at that time, so the fact that they were standing around naked wouldn't have shocked you particularly. But when you would have been shocked is you would have gone over to them and say, which way to the water? And you would have seen like an animal looking back at you there. An animal that lacks the capacity for complex cognition, for sophisticated language. In evolutionary discourse, we are not Homo sapiens. It's almost embarrassing given what fools we tend to be. We are Homo sapiens sapiens. We are the wise, wise humans. Jesus, look in a mirror, guy. But you get the idea. It's rather foolish, but that's what we call ourselves. Our unique form of consciousness came into being, it's estimated, and different scientists will say different things, 65,000 years ago, in what's called the Big Bang of the Mind. To be or not to be, that is the question. That is the question that only Homo sapiens sapiens are capable of formulating to themselves. Your dog will never ask that. We love our dogs, right? But they never say, geez, what is it to be? They never do that sort of thing. Neither did archaic Homo sapiens. Only when we developed rational consciousness, the rational consciousness that characterizes our species, only then did we develop the capacity for moral reasons. We had the moral instincts beforehand, and I'll provide some evidence for that in a second. We had moral instincts beforehand, but we only developed moral reasons. I think we should do this. And listen, Fred, here's why I think so. Now, tell me what you think about this. Here's why I think we should do it. I'm persuading you. I'm looking at your face to see how this is working on you, right? This brings us to the difficulty, really. Typically, blue tribe harangues red tribe, I should say liberals harangue conservatives, with a menu of reasons. They give them all these reasons. And on hot button issues like same-sex marriage, issues like abortion, issues like, don't even look at my gun, damn you. I mean, I've got God wants me to have this gun and lots of others, right? You know, see, I'm already making fun of it, and that's what I'm trying to say we really shouldn't do, and it's difficult not to. Those in blue tribe blue, then tend to question tribe reds and tell these people aren't understanding the issue. They're not getting it. They're incapable of understanding what's going on. The scariest thing about tribe red for many people in tribe blue is that, geez, these guys vote. You know, that's a really scary thought. Has anybody been following the elections, by the way? Jeez, these guys vote. In fact, according to Haidt, the agenda of Blue Tribe is equally grounded in moral instincts, but in different moral instincts. The point is, there's not just moral instincts, period. There's different kinds of moral instincts. And spoiler alert, we need them all. And they all can take sort of shadowy and bad expressions, but we need them all. These moral instincts, as it were installed by natural selection, I'm repeating this now, long before we had evolved into Homo sapiens sapiens. And I'll give you two examples right now, and from ape behavior. I knew somebody who was the curator of primates at the San Francisco Zoo, and so I got to go backstage, and I got to feed the animals. That was just really great, Actually, I hated the chimpanzees, but I love the orangutans, and I like the gorillas just fine. Chimpanzees are too much like us. They're just... Anyhow, female chimpanzees are spectacularly promiscuous sexually, right? They will get it on with anybody except daddy and brother in the wild. Now, when you put them in captivity, all bets are off. But in the wild, they'll have sex with anybody. They know who their father is. They know who their brother is. So clearly, natural selection had installed an aversion to incest and the kind of bad things that are the result of incest. So that's chimpanzees. Now gorillas. Chimpanzees, again, they have an instinct against incest. Gorillas have an instinct for fairness. As I say, I got to feed them. I got to know the gorillas by name. And you keep them in separate cages, especially when you're feeding them, because they'll fight. And, you know, they won't kill each other in the fight, but they'll hurt each other. Here's what I found out. You feed them these little treats. They have their regular... But gorillas like carrots. Little carrots. You put it through the cage to them, right? They like carrots, but they just love grapes. Right? As I say, the animals are kept in separate cages just in case, so they wouldn't attack each other. Take two gorillas, give them both carrots, or give them both grapes, and everything is serene. But if you give one of them carrots, and then in sight of the other, give another one grapes, it's just instant indignation and rage, an inarticulate prefiguring of Occupy Wall Street, right? There it is, right there in the cage. You can do that with dogs too. I don't recommend this because actually after a while you're torturing animals by doing this, but you're upsetting them. But even dogs know if there's the two kinds of treats there. I've got two dogs and I just tested it out once, give one the very good treat, give the other one just, the dog doesn't attack or anything like that. Yeah, she just looks hurt, which is worse, and I have to quickly give her. But they know, and fairness is important to them. Animals have an instinctual sense of fairness. That's the point that I'm trying to make here. Both Bernie and the Donald are appealing to this sense of outraged sense of the fairness instinct, quite literally. They are both playing to that powerfully, and it really works. Interestingly, and this is not most political pundits are also saying this, they play the same issue to different crowds. It's just not fair what's going on right now. And that sense of fairness is something that we can ill afford to fool around with. So, again, in sum, two separate instincts, two sets of instincts that have come to serve as the basis for two different foundational moral reasoning, right? So different moral reasoning grew out of different different instincts. And these differing instinctual foundations is one of the great contributions made by Jonathan Haidt, as a matter of fact. Consider again the recent issue of same-sex marriage. Both red and blue tribes loudly accuse each other in fighting about it. Blue tribe is for it, red tribe is against it. They accuse each other of being immoral, right? Each one accuses each other of being immoral, of being on the one side priggish bigots, on the other side you have shameless hedonists. And while it can be fun to hurl invective, as mentioned earlier, this is a pastime that in our particular cultural milieu we can ill afford, because we live in a culture where things are changing very fast and old models of values, actually, folks, old models of identity are falling into eclipse. I understand that here at the Personal Theology, you sometimes have Walter Truett Anderson come around and talk to you. Is that right? Anybody? Yes? Yeah, okay. He's written a wonderful book. He wrote it was in 1990. That's how long ago it was. And it's titled Reality Isn't What It Used to Be. And he sort of, globalization was just kicking in. The enhanced technology as far as employment prospects was just kicking in. And he was saying, we are facing a major crisis in this culture. Values aren't what they used to be. Identity isn't what it used to be. The nation state is going into eclipse, is what the point is. And to a degree it is. It used to be, the nation states are following the path of state identity. How many of you are from California, born here in California? A pretty good bunch. I'm from Pennsylvania myself, and you know, people come from all, and there, it wasn't so long ago, 50 years ago. Geez, you're from Pennsylvania. What made you come all the way out here, right? And the fact that you are from a state was a significant aspect of your identity. Now, hell, we're all from somewhere, right? Increasingly, your national identity is, hey, we've all got to be somewhere, right? We've all got to be from somewhere. But if you're in the computer business, software engineering, you go from country to country. And it used to be said that the aristocracy has no country. They're all, that's increasingly coming to be the case for many of us. And the nation state has ceased to be a reservoir for identity for many people. As a result, sometimes is referred to as postmodernism, as a result of the anxieties involved in this, people are seeking solace from postmodern anxieties over identity by seeking pre-modern models of identity, ethnic chauvinism, nationalism, religious extremism. So they're going back to this, and it's happening in many places in the world. And one of the reasons for that, Hi, is because things are changing so fast. That's why this issue is so serious, that we've got to be able to come together. Haidt distinguishes six instinctual foundations. I don't have time in this talk to do that. Keying off here in this talk. I'm keying off his book, The Righteous Mind, and he elaborates six different moral foundations. For today's brief talk, I want to summarize them into just two. There's fairness, an aversion to cheating, and aversion to oppression. That's on the one side. That's, I said it's sought by just people who are on blue team, actually red team. Those the Tea Partiers, right? What's their primary motivation? This ain't fair, right? Because things are changing really fast. So fairness and cheating on the one hand, and loyalty is a little bit more complex. Loyalty, authority, and purity, a kind of sanctity and purity. You've got to have loyalty to the group. My dad, I remember when he was around when Nixon was and he was a staunch Republican all his life, and he would say, when people were criticizing Nixon and calling him a crook and everything, he said, "That's the President of the United States you're talking about. This is outrageous." And then he underwent a change when he finally himself became persuaded that the guys, he would have been at the head of a lynch mob to string him up. I mean, he felt so bitterly betrayed because of his feelings of loyalty and authority. That sense of loyalty and authority is very much, it's typical of the red team. It's why, for example, if you remember back in the Vietnam era, when Jane Fonda went over and visited the North Vietnamese troops and how Hanoi Jane, right? And it was spat out in contempt. It's why so many people have difficult times with same-sex marriage. But this is nothing new, really, folks. They say the recent dust-up in Indiana. Well, they're paving over our religious freedoms. They're having no respect for our values. For paving over your religious freedom. That is actually, that's right. That's what progressive society does. Paves them right over. Asphalt, concrete, what he brings some sand in and sprinkle it. I don't mean to be sneering and snarky about that, but it began with slavery, right? We've got to eliminate it. But, you know, God says, and there are serious defenses of slavery based on the book of Genesis. The same passages were used to justify, and I was here for those. I was alive, so were many of you. The fights in the 1950s over integration, and those who were diehard segregationists, the 50s and the early 60s, Genesis chapter 9, Noah commanded his son Ham to be the servant of his quite literally. That was the religious arguments were brought against feminism, right, against the suffrage movement, against women having the vote. And, for example, it was 1971 that in Virginia, a law against what was called miscegenation. You know what that is? Miscegenation is interracial marriage, right? And the law that was standing was there because God himself was a segregationist. I use a Southern accent, and I shouldn't do that, except my wife, who is a Southerner, tells me that's right because she's from the South. But he said God himself was a segregationist. He put different races on different continents, and by having interracial marriage, you are violating God's law. Well, bless his heart, in Loving versus Virginia, that religious freedom was paved over, right? And likewise, the idea that people in the same sex could get married, this is just, it's an affront to everything decent. We got to remember, many of these instincts, these moral instincts, especially for purity, trigger the emotion of disgust. It's disgusting. It's just disgusting. But it was also just disgusting to think of two people of different races getting married together. That's disgusting. Where were their children go to school? It's just irresponsible. So this idea is something that's happening. It's happening at a faster and faster pace, and it's happening in the full glare of publicity, which is, as for example, the recent case that was a year ago or so in Indiana, where people were claiming that their religious freedoms were being violated. Okay. Again, these moral instincts are typically embraced with a sense of certainty. They typically have a sense of impatience for reasons which are just seen as rationalizations when they come from the other tribe. Heights Point, and this is important, all of the moral instincts play a vital and indispensable role in social success. What do I mean by social success? Social coherence. Cooperation, what evolutionary scientists refer to by the fancy word eusociality, basically, how do we live together? A brief aside here. Yes, we Homo sapiens are awfully proud of our intellect, and we should be. We've got this wonderful thing. But while that's the pride of our species, It is obviously indispensable. Equally important is our capacity, a unique capacity that's instinctually built into us, our capacity to cooperate. It began some 74,000 years ago when a supervolcano erupted and drove most archaic Homo sapiens to the point, to the brink of extinction. There were some 2,000 or 3,000 of them left. There were 200 or 300 breeding pairs, to put it that way. If anybody had been keeping an endangered species list, archaic Homo sapiens would have been on it. Nature said, figuratively speaking, metaphorically speaking, learn to cooperate or go extinct. And we did. We had to get smarter to cooperate. That's what launched Homo sapiens sapiens out of its earlier antecessor species, archaic Homo sapiens. Is this making sense, folks? So we got smart by meeting a challenge, and the challenge was to cooperate. Cooperation, without the capacity for cooperation, civilization breaks down, social progress grinds to a halt, and we would live in a world of indisputably smart warlords and hunter-killer bands, right? So we would lose the capacity to cooperate. This insight was central to the thinking of Charles Darwin in Chapter 5 of The Descent of Man. Pardon me for reading this, it's just a short passage. He said, "At first, as the reasoning powers and foresight of the group members became improved, each individual would learn from experience that if he aided his fellow man, he would commonly receive aid in turn. From this low motive of self-interest, he might acquire the habit of aiding his fellows. I help them, they help me. And the habit of performing benevolent actions certainly strengthens the feeling of sympathy, which gives rise to the first impulse of benevolent actions. Habits, moreover, followed during many generations, tend to be inherited." Darwin clearly saw, yes, our intelligence is very important, but equally important is our capacity to cooperate, our tendency toward what actually, E.O. Wilson, the great evolutionary scientist, makes a big deal out of this, out of eusociality. And he says, ants are naturally eusocial. Insects, especially, they're natural. It's instinctual. They live in a world of what's mandated or what's forbidden. Everything not required is forbidden, right? You get that idea. We, however, have these choices, and so we had to learn to make the right choices. That is to say, to set aside or control self-interest to promote the interest of the group, because it was groups largely that served as the vehicle for our evolution. Here's how Haidt makes the very same point in Chapter 10 of The Righteous Mind. He said, "The most effective groups have many ways of suppressing selfishness, and any time a group finds a way to suppress selfishness, it changes the balance of forces from individual selection to group selection, and it becomes more powerful in that process. For example, if there is a genetic basis for feelings of loyalty and sanctity, then intergroup competition will make these genes become more common in the next generation." And again, instincts that he refers to are loyalty and sanctity. Our sanctity is bound up with purity, which sounds all fuddy-duddy. No. He says the chief feeling, our immediate feeling, is disgust. That's the view that we do this. That's why our nose is located right over our mouth. I'm not going to eat that. It doesn't smell right. Right? Something smells bad in here. Let's not make our campsite here. So that sense of purity, if you like, of sanctity, and the purity and sanctity of the human condition. Actually, in this workshop I'm going to be doing in a couple of weeks here, there are many people and many thoughtful people who say, and E.O. Wilson is one of them, Francis Fukuyama, the conservative political commentator, is another, who says, you know, we shouldn't be fooling around with changing the human species. The human species is itself sacrosanct. And many people are speaking the language of, it's called transhumanism, right? So we're going to somehow evolve, and we're going to have humanity 2.0, it's going to be great, you're going to love this. Well, actually, many people are saying, we don't know what we're doing here, and we should at least put a put a slower on it, there are even now genetic techniques. A woman named Jennifer Doudna came up with a brilliant technique for manipulating DNA in the embryo. It's called CRISPR-Cas9. And it's just a way of somehow removing some genes that you don't want there, for example, genes for a genetic disease, and putting in other genes that you do want there, smart genes, right? And she, having invented this process, is now at the head of the choir saying, just we should put a moratorium on this. We don't know what we're doing yet. And if you start fiddling around with the human germline, you could do things when we're doing recombinant DNA research. Many people have said it's kind of like we're at a panel of buttons and we push a button and we hear a whoosh. But we don't know whether we're launching rockets or flushing toilets. And then, so we just don't know enough about this yet. So thank you. Let me draw to a close here. So what is true of the lawyer, he said the loyalty and sanctity foundations are indispensable. And this, it's equally true of the fairness and, let's call it, justice, that sense of oppression, of eliminating oppression. Without both, a culture staggers inexorably into degeneration. Haidt refers to this as the miracle of human culture, and I'm going to quote him one more time. He says, "Religion and political leadership are so intertwined across eras and cultures because they are about the same thing. They are about performing the miracle of converting unrelated human beings into a group. Other animals do that just fine. Wildebeests and zebras, they don't have to worry about it. They just have instinctually forms groups. We have a tendency to think for ourselves. That's the miracle of human cognition. And as a result, we need this magic. And the magic comes from political leadership and religion. Without a sense of group authority, a culture degenerates into the failed state status that characterizes so many Middle Eastern and African countries. Every individual and subgroup for itself, social chaos, easy prey for an authoritarian dictator's agenda. That's without a sense of group authority and loyalty. Without a sense of fairness and justice, a culture quickly degenerates into hostile camps whose primary agenda is resentment and revenge. Any doubts about that? Ask Marie Antoinette. You know who I'm talking about, right? Which is the woman who finally said, well, let them eat. And actually, cake was not dessert. It was a very cheap form of bread. And she ended up with her head on a pike, of course. It's important to notice that Haidt includes religion as powerfully intertwined with political leadership in this, what he calls, a miracle of social cohesion. This is why I suggest it is so desperately misguided of many liberals to disparage and mock the religious disposition in the red tribe. And yes, we can do that easily. It embraces superstition, it embraces bigotry, but it is absolutely desperately needed. Yes, the shadow lurks among among those primordial instincts, but the shadow also lurks among social justice, a sort of intolerance of intellectual diversity, this whole thing about politically correctness. And believe me, I've been in places where strong, it's not coming from red tribe now, coming from strong, dedicated liberals who are outraged that somebody would suggest that natural selection, evolution by means of natural selection, would be attributed to the human condition. We are made by culture, not by natural selection. You're inviting us to go back to the good old days of social Darwinism with its racism and sexism and celebrating violence. No, it's not. But I've got the bite marks that I can show you dueling, as it were, with liberals who are absolutely convinced that this is a disaster. Actually, it's just happened again. E.O. Wilson is the favorite target here. He was attacked scurrilously, I think, by another hero of mine, Stephen Jay Gould, in 1975 for his book Sociobiology. He's been recently attacked by Richard Dawkins as well. You know, he's 85 years old. He's a little bit senile now. Wait a minute. You disagree with him? That doesn't make him senile. You get the idea. So there's this. There's a notion that an intolerance of intellectual diversity is endemic to a large extent in the liberal community. What's needed more than ever here in the 21st century, with its deep and rapid cultural transitions like globalization, like the technological premium that conditions employment opportunities, like the wholesale rethinking of what it is to be human, to be an American, this is the ambiance in which, as I said before, traditional models of identity are felt to be under threat. In such circumstances, certainty is the more attractive state of mind. Any explanation is better than none, and the explanation that relieves anxiety is worthy of certainty. That's the danger. We need to keep our eye on the ball, and we need to not forget that the ultimate ball that we keep our eye on is, in our rapidly changing culture, is what Haidt referred to as the miracle of converting unrelated individual humans into a group. In regard to that miracle, the certainty so craved by many people is a major impediment, I think. John Stuart Mill, a philosopher widely respected among both Red Tribe and Blue Tribe, wrote in his magisterial defense of small l liberalism, he who knows only his own side of the case knows little of that. Haidt's distinction between moral instincts and moral reason, his calling attention to the dangers of thundering certainties rooted in instincts rather than reasons, these, I think, provide a significant advantage in the challenges that we face. What do you guys think of that? We're okay.
Yeah, we have a few minutes for questions. So
one of the things that I keep coming up with about the battle between the reds and the blues is how much fear guides that. That's basically it. And you didn't really talk about the fear that a lot of both sides have about this challenge to identity.
I alluded to it briefly, and I didn't give it the importance that it really calls for. But we are living, as I quoted, or I referred to Walter Truitt Anderson's wonderful book, Reality Isn't What It Used to Be. It's 1990. It's also, but he wrote it and researched it just when things were starting to transition, where identity was now all of a sudden up for grabs. We no longer have beliefs. We are consumers of beliefs. We no longer. So, are you a Jew today or a Buddhist? Or maybe you can be a Jubu, right? In a way, I found this to be very liberating. I had many friends who were Jubus, right? They were Jewish Buddhists, literally, and there was no contradiction for them. But to many traditional, to an Orthodox Jew, this is ghastly. To a traditional Buddhist, well, that's not really Buddhism at all. We are losing all of our traditions, and we are going to throw away something precious.
Hello. Thank you. I have a few questions. I'm going to narrow it down to one, though, for time. What does Haidt say to address people who would, in the example with the brother and sister, people who would say, okay, or like, maybe that's kind of beautiful. It seems like, following the conclusion you're going, that's kind of antisocial, and maybe even like.
He doesn't for a minute suggest that, you know, incest is a lifestyle choice. Actually, probably not. It's really confusing around Thanksgiving time and dinner and what have you. But he uses the story to illustrate the kind of pugnaciousness that immediately comes up when ethical instincts are challenged. It's just goddamn wrong. And if I have to explain that to you, there's no point in talking to you, right? It's kind of like this conversation is over. And it's interesting, and he gives a whole list of questions that were like that. Can you use an American flag to clean your toilet? Well, horrors. The family dog got hit in the car, hit in the street and killed. It was a precious family dog, but the family was poor. Was it offensive for them to eat the dog that night? Well, for many people, this elicits a sense of disgust, as a disgust and a kind of a thundering certainty. That's what's going on. He tells that not to take one side or the other, but to offer an explanation as to what's happening in our culture now with so many of the conflicting certainties. Is that making sense to you?
I'm wondering what he says to the opposite side, people who don't recoil. The people who don't recoil from that, people who don't have that emotional response.
He would say, well done. But he's trying to understand, in other words, why we are at such loggerheads as a culture right now. Why we have these thundering certainties? You're just wrong. And again, it's easy to make fun of this, and I don't want to make fun of it. But you gotta come back. What caused 9/11? Jerry Falwell said, liberals and lesbians. That's what caused it. You know, it's so poorly thought out and misguided, but the thing is, he is saying we have lost touch with our sense of tradition and authority. And we need that sense of tradition and authority, but the thing is, it has to be grounded in a new model now, and that's what he's refusing to see.
Sir, your original hypothesis that rationality is irrelevant when instinct is in play. Oh, I thought that's what the point of this was, that there's no point in arguing with somebody because they have their instincts. But let me phrase this differently. My question is this. What is his account for why people have different views, and what's his account for how people like your father change their views?
Fine. I haven't got time to go into it now. I just don't. It's a good question, a complex question. He believes that these viewpoints are genetic and heritable. So, and that's with all the work that's being done in inheritance now and how we're changing our minds about that, I think he might be wrong on it. But nonetheless, the point is that not that reason is irrelevant, but reason is going to go nowhere. To a certain extent, when you're talking to somebody who is an older person, let's say, just like I am, and he's a born, dyed-in-the-wool Christian conservative, and he just sees it as against God and nature, same-sex marriages. You have to become aware of the fact that you're trying to use reason. This is going to sound awful. You're holding discourse with an ape. Right? That is to say, you are holding discourse with a center that literally evolved and took its form. That this is the way it's done, and this is the. Pardon me? I'm saying that. What? Yes, he did. He changed his mind when he felt betrayed, and it was not an easy change. He was throwing things around the house and stuff like that. He felt ripped off. He felt like Occupy Wall Street. He felt like my dad was a candidate for going out there with the Trumpies, right? What worries me about Donald Trump, I didn't want this to get, but he really plays into those primordial atavistic, nativistic instincts of fear of others, fear of Mexicans, fear of Muslims, fear of blacks. And he encourages, he absolutely encourages violence in his demonstrations, roughing up people. Throw him out of here, get him out. Don't give him his coat back, right? He should have been punched one. So there is, it's kind of like the appeal of authoritarianism. The appeal, if you like, it's one of those words that means so many things that it doesn't mean anything. Fascism, it actually means something fairly concrete. But yes, people do change their minds. Sir?
I can't believe that the aversion to brother and sister marriage is instinctive. During the period when civilization was arising, one of the most successful civilizations was that of Egypt.
Yes.
And in Egypt, brother and sister marriage was commonplace.
Yes.
Especially among the ruling class.
The ruling class.
And
yes.
Their foremost god,
yes.
Osiris.
Yes.
And their foremost goddess, Isis.
Yes.
Were brother and sister.
Yes.
And they married.
And it worked out okay, and it was lucky. Charles Darwin. married his first cousin, and their children were all brilliantly gifted and contributed mightily. But if you fool around with that, the odds are stacking against you. Everybody's heard of Zika virus, and it triggers off a genetic mutation. It triggers off microcephaly. Now, that's a genetic mutation that can also happen by inbreeding. The kingdom, as it were, of microcephaly is Pakistan. Why? Because they have a cultural tradition of marrying first cousins. It's a terrible scene over there because they use the microcephalics. They call them Chua, rat people, because they've got a face that points out like that. And they use them as slaves and sex toys and what have you. It's horrible. But that kind of inbreeding really does. Darwin lucked out. Many people did. But think about the European nobility, the aristocracy. And here's the Duke of Kent. Well, you know, oftentimes they are not the brightest lights on the Christmas tree. And they came from pretty good stock. So what the hell happened? It's the recessive, the cumulative effect of inbreeding. So people who are smarter than me about this stuff say, I take their word for it. Is that making sense?
No.
No? Okay. Okay.
Well, it's not so much a question as toward the end of his book, and he sort of sorts those values into values that support an acceptance of certainty versus uncertainty, but then relates it to people's brain chemistry. Yes. And I'm wondering what you think about the role of brain chemistry, which is genetically based in some sense, and maybe epigenetics depending on the environment. Because I kind of tend to think that people are sort of born with a brain chemistry that either enjoys uncertainty or doesn't.
That's true, and he does talk about that. There are people who seek out uncertainty, who thrive in uncertainty. He also talks about other brain chemistry, where he's been recently kind of demonstrated as wrong. He just celebrates the presence of oxytocin, and he says it's the cuddle hormone, and he said we should put it in the water supply. Oh, it's great. Everybody starts liking each other. Actually, what further research has done is you start liking everybody in your group, but you have enhanced hostility to those outside your group. So hold off on putting it in the water. But it's a huge and a very interesting aspect of what role does inheritance play in this? Do conservative people have children? Again, it's really, don't think of inheritance as being walked in, but do they have a predisposition towards being conservative? And a predisposition that goes beyond simply the environmental circumstances in which they're raised. Folks, I didn't really answer this gentleman's question fully, and I regret that, and I will do better next week. I need to leave. What I love is this back and forth here. Yes, sir.
We don't have any time left for questions. Okay. But thank you very much, and we look forward to you coming back. If you are interested in Bill's workshop, there are some sign-up sheets at the back of the room. Okay, I know you're so rushed.